Hey there, I'm Ange McCormack, the host of Schwartz Media's daily news show, 7am. This is The Weekend Read. Every fortnight on the show, we feature the best long-form writing in Australia, read to you by the people who wrote it. Today on the show, journalist Ange Lavoie-Pierre with her piece from a recent edition of The Monthly. On certain nights in the suburb of Newtown in Sydney, you might stumble across two very different events revolving around essentially the same question. How much sex is too much? In one room, the Sex and Love Addicts Anonymous meeting welcomes those who are ashamed about the size of their sexual and romantic appetites. In another room, down the road, an ethical non-monogamy night allows space and discussion for those who can't get enough. So, with two radically different approaches to love and sex, how do the groups at the opposite ends of the same spectrum, but the same ends of town, navigate matters of the heart? Ange will read her story, Might As Well Face It, after a short conversation. So, Ange, how did you discover that there were two events happening at the same time within striking distance of one another that were essentially interested in the same thing, sex and love, but through totally different lenses?
Yeah, so the conversation night, the non-monogamy conversation night, was actually because I was invited.
Okay.
because I had come to the attention of this group after I came out as Polly on my ABC podcast last year. Yeah, they found me because I literally made a podcast about it being like, I'm Polly. And then SLA, Sex and Love Addicts Anonymous, I had never heard of, but I subscribed to a newsletter, like an addiction newsletter called The Small Bow. I was opening that one day and they were doing a special on sex and love addicts. And it's exactly the same framework as the 12 steps for Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was immediately, my curiosity was piqued because I suppose before I had decided to, for want of a better term, lean in to being poly, and because, you know, I do experience it more as an orientation than anything else, I had definitely wondered if there was something wrong with me. And I saw the way that it was being described by Sex and Love Addicts Anonymous, which is obviously a rabbit hole that I immediately fell down after opening this newsletter, and was, yeah, fascinated. There was a quiz, there was this whole way of understanding yourself as a sex and or love addict. And yeah, I started looking at meetings in Sydney, of which there are 33, for anyone wondering.
Yeah, wow. And so you actually went along to one of those Sex and Love Addicts Anonymous meetings, which I imagine, like you, other people would be surprised actually exists. What was it like? What struck you about it?
It's not all that different to an AA meeting. So AA is like the version of the 12 steps that is best known in the zeitgeist, right? Like, we've all seen that represented, whether it's on like West Wing or whatever, you know.
Chairs,
like,
in a circle.
Yeah, chairs in a circle. Everyone says, you know, the prayer, the words. There are the steps. You do the steps. You apologize. You make a fearless inventory of your failings. You know, it's accepting that you're broken, right? And it is pretty much a direct lift of that. So the 12 steps are the same. They've just sort of replaced the words alcohol or, you know, narcotics. There's Narcotics Anonymous. There's all kinds of different offshoots of the 12 steps, but they've just replaced it with sex and love. So it's incredibly Christian. It's incredibly old-fashioned. In researching this piece, I found out that the 12 steps are pretty much, well, maybe even exactly as they were formulated in 1935. Not from an evidence basis, but by a sort of former Wall Street trader who'd had his struggles with addiction. And it's more or less unchanged. So very old-fashioned, very Christian, but they very much saw themselves as broken. You have to accept that you're broken. And so it was a fundamental difference to the world that I was from. And the whole reason that I decided to do the piece is because as soon as I read the SLA website and the quiz and the steps and all of it, I went, oh, this is like maybe the same people.
Right.
What they have in common is that they have these unconventionally large appetites for sex and or love. But yeah, different approach.
Yeah, one group is kind of celebrating it and one is punishing themselves for time. Having the exact same feelings or behaviour or whatever.
Yeah, it's like through the looking glass.
Yeah. And after spending time at both events, what did you learn about sex and love and I guess the very varied ways people interpret how much sex they should be having or how many partners they should be allowed to have or to love?
I think a lot of things happen in secret. One of the things that was really interesting about the non-monogamy community, because I guess I sort of know the queer non-monogamy community a little bit better, where we have more camaraderie and acceptance in the broader community for living that way, whereas a lot of the people at this conversation night who were looking for support there were maybe mums and dads. They were, you know, people living in regional Australia sometimes, in suburban contexts, and they couldn't talk to anyone about it. They didn't have friends who they could talk about it, or at least they didn't feel that they could. And who am I to tell them that they're wrong about that? What I learned maybe is that as much as we have this narrative that non-monogamy is having a moment and polyamory is, you know, oh, it's all the rage, and sure, that's true to an extent, but I think it's also wildly exaggerated because the norm is being enforced to a great extent still to this day, so much so that the apples that do fall this far from the tree still need special places to go, whatever those places are. But there are people in those meetings who swear by the results, and the reason AA is the way it is, and I suppose SLA for the same reason, is because they find that that model, having to show up every day or as often as possible, helps keep them honest. So people do get something really important out of those meetings.
Mm. Well, thank you so much for your piece, and I look forward to hearing you read it, Ange. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up after the break, Ange Lavoie-Pierre will read Might As Well Face It.
The city of London in Andrew O'Hagan's latest novel is crumbling. But don't mistake this for pessimism. Instead, the author insists it's a necessary process for a better future.
Change doesn't just happen because it's time for a change. Change has to be forced. We live in the end not in countries that are settled places, they're just imagined communities.
I'm Michael Williams, and on this week's Read This, I sit down with Andrew O'Hagan to discuss his latest, Caledonian Road. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Might as well face it. On certain nights, if you throw a stone with enough enthusiasm from the Sex and Love Addicts Anonymous meeting in the Sydney suburb of Newtown, you might just hit the ethical non-monogamy event at a community centre down the road. Aside from a few shopfronts and a dog park, the two gatherings are separated by their radically different answers to an age-old question. How much sex and/or love is too much for one person? At the community centre, 30 or so people, mostly straight-scanning millennial couples, have removed their shoes. They're sitting on cushions, meticulously arranged in a circle around a decorative tangle of fairy lights. It's billed as a night of conversation, and the crowd is a blend of suburban parents, hippie-coded locals, kink devotees, and a lone bearded libertarian. The tone is surprisingly earnest, a little nerdy, and, if you must know, relatively unhorny. The hummus is top shelf. A round of introductions reveals there is a handful of newcomers merely curious about the concept of non-monogamy, but most are already practicing some form of it. Their lifestyles range from occasional swinging right through to kitchen table polyamory, involving multiple romantic and sexual partnerships with the full blessing of all concerned. Everyone has a chance to tell their story. Most often, one half of a committed couple has suggested they open things up. There's a general sense of gratitude at having found themselves here, as if they've been spared a far worse fate. The more experienced, many of whom seem to know one another, are fluent in the novel glossary that has bloomed around non-monogamy since the 90s. Words such as compersion, sympathetic joy in the place of jealousy, and metamour, your partner's partner. Switch up the decor and it could be a mature age uni tutorial populated by the world's most interested students. Down the road at Sex and Love Addicts Anonymous, or SLA, 20 or so adults of all ages, including at least one septuagenarian, are in a circle of their own. In the place of fairy lights, SLA's canonical texts, such as the 12 steps, the 12 characteristics, and the 12 traditions, are taped to the floor. Under a fluorescent glare, members take turns declaring themselves addicts. Some are matter-of-fact or stoic when they say the words, and others mumble. One guy falls asleep. The first of the 12 steps states, "We are powerless over sex and love addiction." The second holds that only God, as you understand God, can restore you to sanity. And step 6, for those who reach it, involves being ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Volunteers from the group compete with an emphysemic air conditioner to read the words on the floor aloud. Finally, members have a maximum of 5 minutes to share. The complimentary biscuits dwindle. A woman knits a white scarf. The sleeping guy has begun to drool. It's giving school detention. The difference is, almost everyone here seems convinced it'll work. SLA and the non-monogamy scene in Newtown may as well be on separate planets, but they share a purpose: to help people who have found themselves, happily or otherwise, operating beyond the limits of what is generally considered an acceptable appetite for love and sex. David is one of the few people who has dabbled in both worlds. He tells me about a period of his life in Los Angeles when he was sleeping with multiple people a day, adding that, "It's a miracle I don't have children or an STD." For a few months before the pandemic, he was often seeing upwards of 7 people at a time. "I was bouncing from bed to bed to bed. I didn't really have a lot of time to do anything else, you know." David reluctantly tells me, yes, he probably was a sex addict back then, but he qualifies it immediately. Was it sex? Or was it love? Or validation? "The stuff I really chased was the person holding me, being there for me, feeling, like, safe, I guess." He explains that even at his most sexually active, everything was above board. Non-monogamy was de rigueur in LA. Ultimately, though, he felt like he was letting everyone down, and he sought professional help. 4 years on, I accompany him to his first SLA meeting. David is one of several newcomers, and he tells me later that declaring himself an addict, in keeping with the custom, felt like being shoved into an ill-fitting suit. As an Alcoholics Anonymous veteran, he's wary of 12-step programs. "It was my therapist who suggested I do AA to try and find community, and I couldn't have been barking up a worse tree. I was immediately set upon." He believes part of the reason he didn't fit into the program was because he wasn't willing to be at its mercy. "I'd rather be a loose unit dealing with a bad hangover than constantly enmeshed in my own lack of self-worth or shame or shittiness." At the end of his first SLA meeting, David feels he has about as much use for it as AA. And he's monogamous now anyway. "That said, it helps a lot of other people," he tells me. The two organisations are separate, but they have a deeply entwined history. It was an AA member in Boston who started SLA in 1976. The group's 12 steps are a word-for-word copy of AA's, first published by former Wall Street trader Bill W. in 1939, except that alcohol is replaced by love and sex. As in AA, members are encouraged to make 4 phone calls a day, 1 to their sponsor, and 3 outreach calls to other members. The meeting protocols are virtually identical. The question of sobriety is an important fork in the road. SLA members define their own sober, or bottom line, and thresholds vary wildly. Complicating matters further, SLA's definition of an addict includes people who avoid intimacy, behaviour referred to as intimacy anorexia. Unlike substance addiction, neither sex or love addiction are clinically recognised, nor listed in the latest edition of psychiatry's diagnostic manual, known as the DSM-5. Nevertheless, SLA's catchment is broad. In fact, reading their self-diagnosis questionnaire, you might wonder if you've also been overdoing it. Take, for example, question 12. Do you feel desperation or uneasiness when you're away from your lover or sexual partner? which has unwelcome tidings for ABBA, who desperately required a man after midnight. Or question 25. Do you find yourself flirting with or sexualizing someone even if you do not mean to? Bound to upset Jennifer Page, who just had a little crush. Question 4 asks all of us, including Roxy Music, do you get high from sex and or romance? Do you crash? And if the answer is I need to score, then it might be time to look for your nearest meeting. As of January this year, there were 71 Australia-wide each week. There's a world in which Chloe might have attended one had she not had a big fucking wake-up call in the form of her now husband Adam. The couple are the first people to introduce themselves to me at the non-monogamy conversation night down the road. Weeks later, in their living room, we're reviewing the SLAR questionnaire. Some of it, such as question 5, have you had sex in inappropriate places, is a turn-on for them. We fucked in a forest on Sunday, Chloe says, laughing. Neither of them has any hesitation telling me they're sex addicts, although the admission feels playful and a little facetious. I'm so okay with that label, says Chloe. It's a part of my life. We make time for our addiction. We prioritise it. Their apartment is filled with professional photos of BDSM scenes. They run kink workshops and photo shoots together as a hobby and a business. Speaking to Chloe now, it's hard to imagine her at SLAR, but her attitude has changed since leaving her job as a sex worker several years ago. When I retired, I dove into scrubbing my life. I ended friendships, I ended acquaintances, I deleted emails, accounts, like everything, she says. It was after that she started seeing Adam, the first partner she'd been open with about her sex work. I was able to have these comfortable conversations, she says, and it kind of reignited my love for all things that were sex. It broke my heart that I cut a lot of those things off, because me scrubbing myself, that was bringing shame to them, right? In SLAR forums online, members often talk about their qualifier, the person or relationship that convinced them they had a problem. By that reasoning, Adam might count as Chloe's disqualifier. I think we've met our match in each other, Chloe says.
To hear more Weekend Reads, you can subscribe to The Weekend Read in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.